It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, we'll take a look at the rise of gun violence in PG-13 movies.
But now we explore the science behind morality and tribalism.
Stories of conflicts between tribes, literal and figurative, fill the pages of our history books, from the Peloponnesian Wars to modern presidential elections. The divisions of these tribes are often based on moral disagreement, our guest says.
And they say that he says that if we understand the process used to make moral decisions, we can overcome these conflicts and use a common morality to resolve questions nationally and globally. Joshua Green is an associate professor of the social sciences and director of the Moral Cognition Lab at Harvard University. His new book is called Moral Tribes: Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. Joshua, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Well, is it possible to see the divides that we're looking at in the United States today? Things like partisan gridlock in Washington, upset over the Affordable Care Act, global warming, as issues of tribal conflict about morality?
Yes, in a metaphorical sense, at least. So the sense of tribes in my book refers to different groups with different moral sensibilities, and we see this in the divide between left and right in politics. I think a nice example of this, a couple of years ago during the Republican primary, Ron Paul, who was running for the Republican nomination, was asked an awkward question by CNN's Wolf Blitzer, who was moderating his debate. And Wolf Blitzer asked him, suppose there's a man who doesn't have health insurance because he just decided he didn't need it, and then suddenly he gets sick and he needs 6 months of intensive care, who pays for that? And Ron Paul said, well, he should have bought a policy. And he said, well, he didn't. Should we just let him die? And Ron Paul was thinking about this. And in the meantime, members of the audience shouted out, yeah, let him die. And those people are essentially saying, look, we're a society of individuals. We're all responsible for ourselves. The collectivism that other people propose is no good. On the other side, you have people, let's say, like Elizabeth Warren, who famously said, look, we're all in this together. Even if you built a wonderful factory and a wonderful business and succeeded by the sweat of your brow, you moved your goods to market on the roads we paid for. You hired workers that we all paid to educate. We're all in this together. And that divide, I think, between an individualist view and a collectivist view is one of the main divides in American politics.
You've read about sort of two different ways that we make these tribal decisions. One is me versus us, and then us versus them. Can you talk about those two different versions?
Sure. So I think another way of putting it is that there really are two fundamentally different kinds of moral problems. So the basic moral problem is the problem of getting a bunch of otherwise selfish individuals to form a group, to basically get people to put us ahead of me. And this is what we're really good at, because this is what we evolved for. We have feelings that make us care about other people, at least other people within our group. We have empathy. We have shame and guilt that makes us feel bad if we don't care about other people. We have anger and contempt that make us motivate other people to be more cooperative and altruistic. But all of that, at least historically, has been about goodness, caring within a given tribe. But different tribes cooperate on different terms. So, for example, you have a Ron Paul kind of individualist tribe that says, look, we're individuals and we take care of ourselves. We have a Elizabeth Warren more collectivist group that says, look, we're all responsible for taking care of each other. It's not that one is necessarily moral or immoral, but that these are different terms on which groups can cooperate, and different groups can cooperate by rallying around different gods, different leaders. And I think that's essentially the big moral problem in the modern world, is not about me versus us. It's about us versus them. It's about different groups with different moral sensibilities sort of written into their emotions, written into their worldview. And that's why we have such difficulty getting along.
And you write that, you know, a lot of the controversy, the biggest controversies that are tribal, concern issues of sex and death. Why do you think that is?
Right. Well, so if you think about it, it makes a kind of sense. That is, that sex and death are the gas pedals and brake pedals of tribal growth. And so traditionally, the reason why sex is highly regulated in the sense of if you're allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that, is that Within a tribe, if you have too many children being born, then people who aren't capable of taking care of them, that can be a real problem. Likewise, when it comes to death, when it comes to, let's say, abortion, or in some cultures where this is an issue, infanticide, or what you do with elderly people when they're dying, on both ends, the beginning of life and the end of life, these are questions about constituting the tribal us. And that's why I think they're such hotly contested issues when you have different tribes with different moral sensibilities about these things.
So you talked about the biggest problem that we have in terms of morality being these different group tribes, and it can be a religious tribe, it can be a national tribe, and this is where we sort of run into the biggest roadblocks. And you suggest pragmatism as one solution. What does pragmatism do when it comes to morality?
Right. Well, so the term that I use, I've called it deep pragmatism, is really, I think, a better name for an older philosophy called utilitarianism. And the idea behind deep pragmatism, as I use the term, is to put our gut reactions aside. We have strong gut reactions about things like abortion or about the death penalty, and instead say, look, we can't agree on maybe what's absolutely right and wrong, or we can't agree on what our gut reactions are very different about these things. But what we can do is look at the evidence and say, what happens if we make abortion illegal? Does that produce good results or does that produce bad results? What happened before or after abortion became legal? What does it look like in other countries? Instead of trying to ask these ultimate metaphysical questions about when a fetus has a right to life or something like that, simply focus on the pragmatics, on trying to produce the best results possible.
But isn't the problem that we can't agree on what those best results are? One person's best result might look different than somebody else's.
Right. So this is where sort of the nitty-gritty of deep pragmatism comes in. So the idea is, what are the results that really matter? And what the sort of founding fathers of this theory said, so this is Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, they said, look, start with anything you care about and keep asking, why do you care about that, until you run out of answers. So you say, well, you went to work today. Why did you do that? Well, I enjoy it. Why else? Well, I need money. Well, why do you need money? Well, to pay the rent. Well, why do you need to pay the rent? Well, I'd be sleeping outside. Well, why don't you want to sleep outside? Well, it's cold. It's unpleasant, right? And ultimately, all of the things that we value, or at least most of the things we value, come down to the quality of our experience, comes down to our suffering, or comes down to our happiness. And the key idea is that this is a common currency that we have. Whatever tribe we may belong to, we all want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. We all want our children and our friends and our relatives to be happy. We don't want them to suffer. And if we simply measure things in terms of net happiness, so to speak, that may not be everything that we care about morally, but this is a kind of common ground that we could converge on when trying to make these social decisions. Now, it's not that people aren't biased. It's not that people aren't going to take their gut reactions and then use that to color their view of the evidence, but the idea is that if we at least try to focus on the evidence with 10 steps forward and 9 steps back, that can make more progress than simply making bald assertions about who has which rights.
Well, if we're looking at happiness, right, so this is a huge area of research right now. There are tons of happiness researchers out there studying it, looking at what makes us happy. One thing that seems to be sort of emerging as a happiness maker is agency, freedom of choice. So does that mean, just by virtue of what makes us happy, we're going to be legislating and making decisions that lean toward freedom of choice and freedom of will?
I think over historical time, that's certainly true, that people have much more ability to sort of steer their own ships and lead their own lives today than they have in the past. And for the most part, I think that that's a good thing. It doesn't mean necessarily that any choice, that all freedom is good. Is the freedom to pollute good for everybody? Probably not, right? So some constraint on our freedom is certainly likely to promote the greater good. But overall, I agree with what you said, which is that for the most part, people are pretty good at making themselves happy, and giving themselves more freedom is on average a good thing.
Now, looking back at politics for a moment, you look at liberals and conservatives as examples of tribes in your book, and that liberals perceive their circle of their tribe as bigger than conservatives do. How do you explain that?
Yeah. Right. So this is an interesting thing. So coming back to that contrast between, say, Ron Paul and Elizabeth Warren, what's interesting about Ron Paul is he himself didn't just say, let that man die. What he said is, actually, that man's friends and family and the man's church, perhaps, should take care of him. And what that suggests is that a lot of people who present themselves as pure libertarians, as pure individualists, what they really are tribal moralists, who just have a smaller circle of us. So it's not necessarily that conservatives like Ron Paul are saying, look, every one individual is out for him or herself. It's that I believe in a smaller us, the smaller us of the family and my personal friends and perhaps my church, and I'm not interested in devoting my resources or having to come to some kind of agreement about what to do with the larger national us that consists of many people who I don't consider a member of my tribe.
Well, we're talking with Joshua. Sure, go ahead.
I was going to say, in contrast, I think people like Elizabeth Warren believe in a larger us, where we're all in this together, independent of our sort of historical tribe of origin.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about that when we come back, as we're talking with Joshua Green. He's the director of the Moral Cognition Lab at Harvard University. His book is called Moral Tribes: Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them.
Well, what do you think about all this? Do you think we can overcome tribal divisions by, as our guest suggests, thinking rationally with this deep pragmatism? Or are we doomed to live in a world of us and them forever? Do we need to find some kind of common morality to solve national problems, world problems? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Continue our conversation now with Joshua Green. His new book is Moral Tribes: Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Do you think that we can overcome tribal divisions by thinking rationally with deep pragmatism? Or are we all doomed to live in a world of us and of them? Do you have any solutions for reconciling these different sorts of tribes that we have right now? And do we need a common morality to solve the world's big problems? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, I want to go back to the common morality that you're hoping we can move toward, and you call it deep pragmatism. What would that look like, say, if we were practicing it in Washington right now?
Right. Well, let me give you an example I think that's particularly relevant today, given what's going on in the Philippines. So one basic feature of human morality, as I said, is that we care a lot about the local us, but the distant them doesn't seem to be so important. And this was illustrated by a thought experiment from the philosopher Peter Singer from many decades ago. He asked, suppose there's a child who's drowning in a pond right in front of you, and you could wade in and save that child, but if you do this, you're going to ruin your fancy new suit that you just got. Now, is it okay to let the child drown because you're worried about your suit? Well, everybody says no, that would be morally monstrous. And then Peter asks a different question. He says, suppose that there are children on the other side of the world who are in desperate need of food and medicine, and for the price of a nice suit, you could probably save one of those children's lives. Is it okay to spend your money on a luxury that's nice but that you don't really need, like an extra nice suit, when you could spend it on children who are far away, for example, now people who are in desperate need in the Philippines? And Peter Singer's utilitarian challenge, saying, look, let's maximize the greater good, is to say, is it there really a big moral difference here? Why must you save the child who's drowning right in front of you, but not make a substantial donation to people who are in desperate need far away? Clearly, they need your resources much more than you need an extra nice new suit. And this is where the one thing we haven't talked about yet is the science behind all of this, which is really what I do. Let me give you an example of some science, I think, that sheds light on this. So with Jay Musin, we did an experimental version of the Peter Singer problem that I just described. So in one version, you are in this lovely but poor country. You have your little cottage up in the mountains overlooking the coast, and the coast has been devastated by a typhoon, coincidentally. This is what was in our experiment from many months ago. The best thing you can do to help the people down on the coast below is to make a donation to the Red Cross or Oxfam, who are on the ground and helping. Do you have an obligation to help? Most people in our sample, 68%, said yes. You ask a different group of people this question. Your friend is over there in that country, and you're at home in your computer. Your friend has a smartphone and is taking video and showing you everything that's going on. You can help just as much as your friend. You can make a donation online to the Red Cross. Do you have an obligation to do that? And there, about half as many people, about 34% in our sample, said you have an obligation. So just the physical distance there, what's sort of, I think, nicely shown by this little experiment, seems to make a very big difference in our sense of moral obligation. So to come back to the philosophical question, what a deep pragmatist or utilitarian perspective says is, look, a human life is a human life. And our heartstrings may not be tugged very easily from people who are far away, and there may be good psychological and evolutionary reasons why we're designed that way. But does that really make sense? Why is the life of some poor Filipino child who's now in a very desperate situation, why is that less important than spending money on things that we don't necessarily need for ourselves? So I think that's a global example of what it means to apply this kind of philosophy.
Well, how do you make sense of what's going on in people's brains as they sort of try to parse that out and make those decisions?
Right. Well, so I think what's going on here is there's a tension between our gut reactions on the one hand and our capacity for abstract thinking. So on a gut level, the child who's drowning right in front of you really tugs on those heartstrings and says, of course you must help. You'd be a monster if you just let this child drown because you're worried about your suit. Whereas the children on the other side of the world, you may feel a little bad, but you don't feel like you would just be a horrible, terrible person if you didn't make a $500 donation to the Red Cross today. But in terms of the actual consequences, they're the same. And with your abstract reasoning, you can say, you know what, in terms of consequences, these things really are the same. And even though one feels like an absolute moral obligation and the other feels like a nice thing to do but something that's not morally obligatory, you can say, what is the real difference here? And the science can help as well, because the science can help us isolate exactly what triggers that feeling. And it turns out that it's something as seemingly inconsequential as mere physical distance, at least in the case that I described. So gut reactions versus more abstract thinking about consequences, I think that's the real tension. And in some cases, at least when we're dealing with us versus them, when we're dealing with people from another tribe on the other side of the world, it's that more abstract thinking that's going to get us to what I at least think is a morally better place.
Let's get our callers in on this. We have Ryan on the line now from Shorewood. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good.
What do you think?
I have an overall question. It's about Freudian psychology, the idea of the other. It's something we just talked about in our literature class. And I was wondering how that would fit in a modern society.
Well, I have to say, I know very little about Freud. And in fact, Freud tends to be taught more in literature classes these days than in experimental psychology departments. So you're catching me as a non-expert there. But what I would say is that we are certainly predisposed, I think, biologically to divide the world into us versus them. So I'll give you an example. This is research done by Catherine Kinsler and colleagues. If you take young children, and you have two people approach them, and they each are offering a toy, and one of them has a native accent and the other has a foreign accent but is perfectly comprehensible, the children would prefer to take the toy from the person with the familiar accent than the person with the foreign accent. And there are other examples like this as well. The more general point is that we, from a very young age, are looking for signals about who's one of us and who's one of them in order to favor us, perhaps at the expense of them.
All right. Well, thank you, Ryan. Hope that answered your question. And let's go to Pat in Birchwood next. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, I guess one of the things that when I was listening, and I don't know that I heard everything that's been going on, but my sense of it is, you know, and when my wife and I are involved, we go overseas to do some stuff in a country, you know, and basically it sounds nice that we could have some sort of, and I'm assuming the direction is that we'd have some sort of global system or some sort of national system that solves people's problems or helps people that are in need. And therefore, you know, and everybody would be helping for that, you know, maybe through taxes, maybe through everyone contributing to something, whatever, like, you know, the Red Cross, whatever it might be. The problems that I see with that, because I've seen it firsthand, is, you know, we contribute towards something or we seek to support something to make it better for someone somewhere else. But ultimately, if you're not directly involved, and just like even in a local community, if you're not directly involved in helping the people that need that help, you're not always necessarily providing the help that's needed.
All right. Let's leave it there because we're getting short of time. Joshua, is that an example again of proximity?
Well, what I would say is that it's actually an example of deep pragmatism, which is to say you don't want to just help because it makes you feel good. You want to help in an effective way. And so if what it requires to help in an effective way is not to just give money to the first organization that asks for it and says that it's going to do some good, but to actually think about how is my money actually going to be used, and do the people who are using it really know how to give these people what they need, or are they just, you know, pursuing their own agenda. One, I think, good way to do this, not the only way, is to look at a website called GiveWell.com, which is an organization that specifically evaluates the efficacy of different kinds of charities. And so it may be true that, you know, a lot of money is wasted with good intentions, but all that matters for us to do good is to have one charity that doesn't waste money. And so I think it's very important, as the caller said, to not only have good intentions, but to actually do our best and do the research and actually figure out how can we use our money to actually be the most effective.
All right. Well, Joshua, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Joshua Green. He is the director of the Moral Cognition Lab at Harvard, and his new book is called Moral Tribes: Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them.
Next is the news from NPR, and then a look at a big jump in gun violence in PG-13 movies. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on the show, we'll talk about a new study that suggests firstborn children are actually smarter than their younger siblings. We'll find out some of the explanations why that could be.
First, according to a new study, the amount of gun violence shown in PG-13 films has more than tripled since 1985, the year the rating was introduced.
And some of the most popular PG-13 films in recent years have contained as much or more violence than their R-rated counterparts. So what effect, if any, is this having on younger viewers?
Joining us now is Brad Bushman. He's co-author of the study and professor of communication and psychology at The Ohio State University. Brad, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, as we said in the introduction there, gun violence, you found, is more than tripled in PG-13 movies. Now, I think a lot of families see this as sort of the softball rating, which is good for a lot of age groups. But what do you make of that finding?
It's very disturbing, especially since the Motion Picture Association of America's MPAA website says that R-rated films contain more violence than PG-13-rated films. And actually, the exact opposite is true. PG-13 films contain significantly more gun violence than R-rated films.
I guess the big question is why? Why is there so much violence in this particular niche rating instead of, you know, R, where it's supposed to be?
Well, I think because the industry wants money, and PG-13 films attract much larger audiences than R-rated films. So that's my guess.
It used to be that if you really wanted to, you know, sell your movie, you marketed to teenage boys. Is that still true? And if it is that part of this?
Well, I think PG-13 films are marketed to teen audiences, and it's troubling that they contain significantly more gun violence than R-rated films.
Can you talk a little bit about how you measured this and what else you found?
Yeah, sure. Well, we had a huge sample of studies. Actually, we looked at the top 30 grossing films every year since 1950. There are 945 films that we looked at. We looked at every 5 minutes of the film and counted the number of violent acts. And then from 1985 is the first year that the PG-13 rating was introduced, we looked at every five-minute segment as well, and counted the number of violent acts that depicted guns. And when the results showed that when the PG-13 rating was introduced in 1985, PG-13 films had about as much gun violence as G-rated and PG-rated films, which is basically none or very little. And by 2005, they contained as much violence as R-rated films, and that continued to climb. And in recent years, they've contained significantly more gun violence.
Now, so in terms of why we might be concerned about this, you talk about something called the weapons effect that could come into play with all these depictions of gun violence. What do we know about the weapons effect?
We know that the mere presence of a weapon makes people more aggressive. It's been replicated many times. In fact, in some of our studies, you don't even need to see the weapon. We did one study where participants saw the word gun for 17/100ths of a second at a subliminal level, and they were more aggressive afterwards. So it's in the human brain, the link between guns and aggression is very strong.
Any particular impact on teen audiences, or is this just across the board? We see a gun and we act more aggressive.
It's across the board. Well, we haven't looked at the effect in really young people, but for teens and young adults and adults, the effect occurs.
Can you clarify a little bit what the ratings are supposed to mean and what the content, how the content is supposed to match those ratings?
Well, it's supposed to match, but it doesn't, and that's the problem. I think many parents think that PG-13 films contain less violence than R-rated films, and I think they'd be shocked to discover they actually contain significantly more violence, and it's a big problem. We know from other research that teens who see movie characters smoke cigarettes think they're cool. They're more likely to experiment and try smoking themselves. And, of course, once you start smoking, it's some people never stop. The same is true with alcohol. Research has shown that young audiences who see movie characters drinking alcohol think they're cool and are more likely to experiment with alcohol themselves. What we would like to know and what we're doing future research to test is whether young viewers who see movie characters using guns, if they think that's also cool and if it changes their perceptions about guns and actually whether they're more interested in guns. So that's where our research is heading.
So what gets a movie an R then? Is it just sex? If it's not violence, is that what's left?
Yeah, I think so. And I guess what we'd like to suggest is the movie industry go back to the way it was when the PG-13 rating was introduced. So R-rated movies haven't changed much. A movie's always received an R rating due to sex or sometimes profanity, such as the F word. But what has changed dramatically is there used to be depictions of violence were rated R, but that's no longer true. And we think they should be. We think that films containing gun violence should be rated R.
I'm curious about what kind of movies, you know, in a time capsule in 1985, it would have gotten a PG-13 rating, and now what a typical PG-13 example would be. Can you give a couple examples?
Well, we know the reason PG-13 rating was introduced is because of movies like Indiana Jones. But the movies now that we looked at were movies such as The Dark Knight, Terminator, Salvation, Inception, Transformers, Dark of the Moon, Captain America, The First Avenger, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol.
Matrix?
The Avengers. I think that may have been rated R. I'm not. I don't have all the ratings in front of me. But what's really interesting is that the Terminator movies, for example, used to all be rated R, and the most recent version, Terminator Salvation, was rated PG-13. And our analysis actually shows it contains more gun violence, the PG-13 version, than the previously rated R versions. The same is true for the Die Hard series. The old Die Hard series movies were rated R, but the most recent version, Live Free or Die Hard, was rated PG-13, and it actually contains more gun violence than the R-rated versions.
So if you're a parent who's concerned about this, I mean, what's the solution if you've got, you know, a 13-year-old, 14, 15, and, you know, they want to see the movies that their friends are seeing, you're concerned about the effect of violence, what should parents do?
Yeah, well, they won't be so popular with their kids, but just because a movie's rated PG-13 doesn't mean that kids 13 and older should see that movie. Certainly, kids under 13 should not see it.
Is part of what we're kind of talking around here the fear that, you know, we're living in an era right now of mass shootings, Newtown, Columbine, and kids who are impressionable will go to these movies and they'll be more likely to walk away with a blueprint?
Yeah, we don't know. We do know that children learn scripts for how to behave from observing other people. It could be their parents or siblings or peers or media characters, and they use these scripts to guide their own behavior when they're in similar situations. Of course, we will never know whether violence in the media causes violent criminal behavior. We know there's a link, but we don't know if it's a causal link, just like we'll never know whether smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer, because you can't do experimental studies to test it. You can't randomly assign people to smoke or not smoke and see whether they get lung cancer. And likewise, you can't randomly assign kids to watch violent or nonviolent movies and then give them guns and see what they do with those in our laboratory experiments. It's just not possible or ethical to do that, and we wouldn't want to even if we could. So, but we do know that violence in the media causes aggressive behavior. We do know that kids who are exposed to violent media behave more aggressively. It can make them behave more aggressively, and it can also make them numb to the pain and suffering of others.
So what would you like to see change based on what you found?
Well, I'd like to see films that contain gun violence rated R.
All right. And do you think the odds are pretty good that, you know, the Motion Picture Association will check out this study and do something about it? Or is this, you know, kind of a long shot?
Well, I've contacted the Motion Picture Association of America to share the results of our study with them. Haven't heard back from them yet. I know that several of the journalists who have interviewed me about this study have also tried to contact them, but they none of them have heard back either. But it's a huge problem, because I think parents rely on these ratings to make choices about the media diets for their children, and they count on these ratings to be accurate. And the Motion Picture Association of America's website says that R-rated films contain more violence than PG-13 films, when exactly the opposite is true. PG-13 films contain significantly more violence than R-rated films, and that's a big problem.
All right. Well, Brad, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
We've been talking to Brad Bushman. He's a professor of communication and psychology at The Ohio State University.
Coming up next, a look at why firstborns may be smarter than their younger siblings.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
A new study says first children may be smarter, that firstborns perform better in school, they have higher IQs than younger siblings. But why? Well, we've got Derek Thompson with us. He's senior editor for The Atlantic, where he oversees the business channel. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So first, tell us about this study. What did they find?
Right. So, you know, when I grew up, I sort of subscribed to what I called the first pancake theory of parenting, the idea that, you know, the first pancake tends to come out a little funny, and so the kids tend to get better as they proceed. My younger sister certainly is a lot more responsible than I am. But, you know, you go around the world, and people have studied this question, you know, who performs better in school, who earns more later in life? Is it first children or second and third children? And it's not just here in the U.S. It's all around the world that you see surveys of birth order finding that the firstborn have higher IQs, they perform better in school, their parents consider them more accomplished. So it is this study in particular that looked at children, but it's also a lot of other studies, which gives you a sense that, you know, it's not just a mistake that a couple researchers made a few years ago. This is potentially a very real thing.
And this keeps holding up in all these different studies.
Yeah, exactly right. And so, you know, people have sort of tried to figure out, all right, we seem to have stumbled upon something, that first children have higher IQs, that their parents consider them more successful, more attuned in school. That's certainly what this recent study showed that looked at parents' evaluations of their children. And so the question is, right, why exactly is this the case? And, you know, there's a lot of theories. One that I find sort of interesting, the first that I find most intuitive, is just the divided attention theory. If you think of attention like any other currency, the idea is that earlier born siblings simply enjoy more parent time. And then as there are more siblings, attention is divided between fewer kids, and each subsequent child receives less parenting.
So the parental attention is a constant. The first kid gets n divided by 1, the second gets n divided by 2, and so on.
Perfectly
down the line.
Said. Exactly.
All right. And so that's one of them, divided attention. Now, some people, and this seems to be going away, but there's a genetic idea that the good stuff, good genes got used up early.
Right. There's the bad genes theory. You know, one that I find somewhat intuitive is what I call the I've had it with kids theory. And here's the idea that, you know, let's say, you know, you're a parent, you have a first child. It's absolutely fantastic. You love it. Maybe you have another and another, and you only stop when you realize that, you know, the last child is simply too much work to possibly consider another. In that case, you're going to stop essentially with the worst child, and not have any more. You're not going to divide your attention anymore going on down the line. But this particular study, the most recent one, is what I call the lazy parent theory. And here's the idea that you have first time parents. And they don't want to you know, mess up their new child, so they essentially install a lot of energy into making sure that that this first kid sort of acts as the enforcer for the younger siblings. And so essentially the older child learns to be a kind of surrogate parent, and that there are certain advantages to being put in this position. So that within the family, the first child is lucky because he or she has the chance to teach and to instruct and to be a father or mother figure for the younger siblings. And that this is really, really good for development. So that for developmental reasons, there's a lot of advantages to being the first one born.
And then another theory that you wrote about is a different permutation of laziness, I guess, with that first kid. And I felt this as a first-time parent, not wanting to get things wrong. You're putting your all into it. You're checking each step of the way, avoiding those screw-ups. And then after you've been through it, you're like, wow, I really overthought a lot of that. And so you're more hands-off on the second kid. Well, but maybe that crazy overparenting the first time around paid some kind of dividends.
Right, exactly. Right. The idea is that, you know, for the first child, you essentially, you know, you buy Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, and you just memorize every single chapter, and you're like, I'm going to be the best parent ever.
You're going to be the president violin, you know,
right,
sports star.
Yeah. And all of this stuff. And then, you know, over time, you realize that you don't have to go through all of this to raise a child that's good enough, that you love, that you enjoy hanging out with, that doesn't cry too loudly in restaurants and all of this. And so you chill out. And in chilling out, potentially, you can see that, you know, there may be minor differences in achievement level in school, because you essentially say, I don't need all of my children to be A+. I'm okay with B+ or B, so long as they turn out to be nice people.
Mm-hmm. Now, and then there's the divorce theory. Talk through that one.
Right. And so this is the idea that, you know, a family crisis probably isn't going to happen, you know, before the first child is born. You know, you have divorce often. If you have a first child, in any case, it's usually while the first child is alive. And so that disruption, which might not take place during the developmental process of the first child, is taking place, and that disruption is very present in the life of subsequent children. And so there you see that a divorce will have a higher and more serious impact on the second, third child than it will on the first, because that first child is more likely to have grown up, at least initially, with a unified home.
Well, now here's another thought. I don't know if this theory came up in what you looked at, but is there a societal assumption that first kids are going to be better in some way and get more attention? And that's just talking about it demoralizes the younger siblings and makes them not try as hard.
You know, right, my sense, honestly, is that you can come up with a rationale for why almost any kid is likely to be the most coddled, right? If you're the first child, you know, you are royalty. If you're the last child, you grow up the baby. If you're the middle child, you have this experience of negotiating authority while being an authority figure to your younger child. There's all sorts of ways you can, you know, rationalize why any given child should technically be the smartest, the most well-adaptive. And as you know, there are all sorts of theories about what older children are like and what middle children are like and why younger children need more attention and so on and so forth. What I found interesting about these studies and these theories is that they're not just old wisdom. This is research, and it's not just U.S. research. It's research around the world in Scandinavian countries too that do seem to show that for whatever reason, the first child seems to have a higher IQ, seems to perform better in the eyes of their parents.
Well, it seems like
and so here the rationales have to be searched for because the data is there.
Well, and it seems like this is just IQ. I could say I did a little better in school than my younger brother, but he's more creative. He's better at hands-on stuff than I am. Is there just in 30 seconds or so? Is there research into other ways of measuring the output of the different birth order kids?
Right. Yeah, I mean, here, you're right. You're essentially saying, what can we know about kids at this young age that can sort of predict their future outcomes? And unfortunately, we don't know that much. IQ tends to be a decent but not, you know, terribly perfect predictor. The truth, honestly, is that, and this is going to be such a cop-out answer, I apologize in advance, there are just billions of children. So you're going to have so much variety of experience, first, second, third children, and increasingly in developed countries where there are more. But, you know, I think what's important to know about this study is that when you look at Europe, Japan, the United States, other developed countries, families in these countries aren't having three or four kids. They're having one or two. And so they're going to pay much more attention to research that looks at what are first and second children going to be like.
All right, Derek, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Derek Thompson, senior editor for The Atlantic.